Hi, this is Vic Mignogna, Captain Kirk from Star Trek Continues, and guess what? You're listening to the Shuttle Pod.
All right, welcome back, everybody, to the 24th episode of the Shuttle Pod. Can you believe it? 24 episodes.
Wow, we only look a day over 21.
Exactly. That's what I've been saying. Okay, so now this is our This Side of Paradise episode, if we're going by what the 24th episode of the original series was.
Nice.
Which
I love that episode.
Yeah, it's good. It should be on everyone's top 10 list. And it's fitting because in today's episode of the Shuttle Pod, the battle for paradise has begun. Which was, of course, the tagline to Star Trek Insurrection. Now, today is October 12th, 2016. We are gradually working our way through the different actual Trek movies in our namesake. The last one of these we did was First Contact, and so we wanted to do a deep dive into its successor, Insurrection. Now, I know both of you guys have seen this recently. I haven't for a while. But it's one that I have, I think is an oddity in the Star Trek franchise in many ways, because so much about the movie's production and things they're trying to do with it are more interesting to me than the movie itself ever was. Anyway, I've talked too much. My name is Jared Whitley, and I'm joined by my friends.
I'm Kaylee Iacovino.
And this is Brian Drew.
Okay, well, let's get into it. Okay, we have various ideas. We'll try to get through this as best we can. I'm sure it'll take longer than we expect, and it'll be magnificent every second of it.
It always does.
Okay, so Kayla, can you give us an overview? What happens in this movie? What's the plot?
Sure. Let me think about that. All right. So, Star Trek Insurrection, not one of the favorite films of the franchise.
Yeah.
Often described as more like a long episode of the original series, which I think personally to be true. I'm sorry. More like a long episode of The Next Generation.
Yeah, and not a particularly good one either.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of things I really like about the story, but, you know, we could talk about that more. But what is the story? So we start on this planet. It seems to be this really sort of an older, I don't even know what year of Earth's history that would represent, but
it's kind of Bronze Age-y, I think.
Yeah, I guess so. It's like a farming, they're a farming, little farming community.
It's like the Bronze Age if everyone still had showers and
we're very
shampoo
clean
and deodorant and razor.
And probably medicines because everyone's healthy and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And razors.
It's all very artisanal.
Yeah, they're all doing arts and crafts and making quilts and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, so we're on this planet, and it turns out that actually we find out through a series of events that it's not actually a Bronze Age planet. They have long had warp capability, but have chosen to abandoned technology, and they moved away from their home planet and found this little planet in the middle of a weird region of space called the Briar Patch, which is just full of weird anomalies and difficult for ships to fly in and out of. And conveniently for the plot, it's difficult. You can't get a message out to Starfleet when you're in the Briar Patch. So you're isolated out there. We discover that luckily for these people, they found this planet that happens to have some metaphasic rings that allow them to stay young and beautiful forever. So, of course, there is the tension in the plot where everyone wants to use the power of the metaphysic rings for their own good. It's a story about forced relocation of people. It's a story about, you know, interspecies conflict. It's a story about family. It's a story about revenge.
Yep.
And it's a story about how to stay beautiful and pretty forever.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so thank you for the summary. Here's my question for you. What is the theme of Star Trek Insurrection? Like in movies, typically there's a line where somebody will say it to the hero in the first act. They'll say what the theme of the movie is. The hero doesn't get it. And then by the closing scene, by the last act, the hero has learned the lesson, and he or she repeats the theme, right? So, like in Star Trek II, we have Spock at the beginning. He says to Kirk the line about, "You have been and always shall be my friend. It is a far better thing I do today than I've ever done before." And Kirk, who's depressed about his life, is hearing that, you know, he didn't have a family with Carol Marcus and David, but his family with the crew of the Enterprise is more important, right? So that's the theme. That's the theme of Wrath of Khan. So what's the theme of Insurrection? And if you don't have an answer, that's okay, because that's what we'll explore. But that's what that's the bug I want to put in your ear. What is the theme of Insurrection?
I don't know. There are a lot. I don't know that there's one.
Yeah.
Theme.
I don't.
Because the first half of the movie is about forced relocation of people.
Okay, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's where it seems like that's going to be the big conflict. And then later, of course, we find... Can I give spoilers?
Yeah, go for it.
Later, of course, we find out that the Baku and the Sona are the same race, and this is about revenge and coming back to, you know, to get revenge on the Baku for having exiled the Sona. So that sort of changes the tone, doesn't it?
A little bit, yeah. Well, and it also, to the evil admiral, and I'm putting evil in quotation marks with my fingers, it's like his, that gives the excuse for this to not be violating the Prime Directive, because it's not one species invading this other species, it's a conflict among the same group of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and at one point he even says to Picard, you know, the Baku are not indigenous to this planet. The Prime Directive doesn't apply.
Doesn't apply.
If he had known that they were not pre-warp, he could have used that as an excuse as well.
Yeah. So it's kind of about the Prime Directive too, but not in any way that I think is resolved or explored or raises questions meaningfully.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're going to try to explore what the theme of the movie is. Now, I think we're all going to probably be a little critical of Insurrection, and so I wanted to start off with some praise that I have for it at first, because there are some things that this movie does really well. And honestly, it's a movie that is much better directed than it is written. And Jonathan Frakes...
Oh, hell yeah.
Jonathan Frakes' skills still come through really well, to the point where... I just don't understand why they didn't put him in charge of Nemesis. And I need to ask him that at a convention once, because I'm sure he really wanted to be able to do it. Anyway, so we mentioned that, and then you said that it's like an episode of TNG. And the way in which I think this is more like an episode of TNG than any of the movies is that it has a very lighthearted tone. It's very bright. It's pleasant to look at. I mean, there's no, like, Picard weeping over his dead brother and nephew in a darkened room. There's no, like, mind rape by a weird Romulan monster, you know?
Although, to be fair, like, Troy got mind raped kind of a lot in the show, too.
Yeah, but yes.
She's just getting mind raped all the damn time.
Yeah, it almost as though, you know, there's a line in the episode Night Terrors where Data says, "No technology has been developed to block telepathic transmission." And I'm like, why not? If necessity is the mother of invention, we really need something like that.
Deanna needs it.
Yeah, seriously. Okay, so I love the first act of Insurrection. I really like that we have the this diplomatic conference where they're in they're meeting with this warp this species that just barely developed warp capability, and Picard has to dance with their ambassador, and he has to wear some weird hat.
Mm-hmm,
and
you know the
aliens have like eaten the floral arrangements because they thought they were dinner, and it's just it's lighthearted. It's what Star Trek should be. I really like that. It's interrupted with this business with Data, and they have to go get Data, and they sing the Gilbert and Sullivan song from HMS Pinafore, and all of that is terrific. So anyway, Brian, what do you want to say? I'm talking.
No, I mean, you were talking about the lighthearted tone. I know that was a mandate from Patrick Stewart that they to like basically make a much breezier movie. this time around.
And
I don't know. That may have been something that the studio was looking for as well. I'm not sure, but I know that Patrick in particular, you know, wanted to lighten the mood a bit.
And it certainly starts off that way very, very successfully. And there's even some good jokes, like when Worf shows up, who was on Deep Space Nine at the time, which was in the middle of its seventh season, and Picard says, "Mr. Worf, what the hell are you doing here?" And Worf starts explaining, and somebody
and they
comes
cut
in,
him off.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. I love that.
That is pretty great.
Yeah, they're just completely cheating, right? And they're
yeah. Let's not even bother explaining.
No, we're here because it's in Michael Dorn's contract, and because it wouldn't be a Star Trek movie without Worf. And I just love that.
Right.
And then, you know, later on when Riker shaves his beard, there's a line where he says that his skin is as smooth as an android's bottom. And Data touches him, you know, to feel it. And I think, if I recall correctly, in the original version of the script, he was supposed to make some comment about the subcutaneous moisture or whatever, some kind of techno babble. And instead, Brent Seiner said, "Nah, just let me do a look." And he gives some little look where he's like, "Nah, your skin is not as smooth as my butt, dude." And it's terrific.
Perfect. The look is terrific.
Yeah, and it's just, you can tell this is just family of actors who've been working together for, at that point, 11 or 12 years. They've got one of their own in charge in Jonathan Frakes, and they're gelling beautifully. But that's about it. I don't know what else positive I have to say. Kayla, do you have anything else, positive things to say about this or otherwise in the movie before we kind of lay into it?
Yeah. And I, you know, I'm happy to once again pepper my very positive views throughout our discussion. Sort of like which we talked about.
It's okay. In a universe of infinite diversity and different combinations, it's okay for a Star Trek fan to like something from Star Trek.
Go figure.
Despite what you see on the internet.
No, I mean, there's a lot of problems with it, but just like when we had our discussion about Generations, there's a lot of things I really like about that movie. Like, I enjoy watching it. And, you know, I was watching Insurrection last night, and I really enjoyed watching it.
Good.
Moments.
Good.
And there are a lot of, you know, to the writer's credit, there are a lot of moments, a lot of themes that I think are, you know, that they try to tackle that also is very, you know, Star Trek Next Generation is very lighthearted and happy and, you know, rainbows and puppies. But it's also... It also did tackle quite a bit of very serious, you know, social issues.
Sure, sure.
And I think they tackle a number of them in Insurrection.
And the thing about talking about social issues is they always did it in a positive way, not like in a needlessly dark for the sake of being dark way, which is what, you know, Nemesis fell victim to.
Yeah, I would agree.
Right.
Okay, so... one of the things that I'm going to point out, and maybe I mentioned this in First Contact, but what we have in all the way through TNG, through most of it, especially in the early years, is there's typically a ship mission and an away mission. And usually the ship mission is what's happening with Picard, and the away mission is what's happening with Riker, right? Which is very different from Kirk and Spock, where it was always the two of them together, right? But with TNG, with the idea that instead of a triad of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy representing the ego, the superego, and the id, we have Picard, Riker, and Wesley as idealized versions of Gene Roddenberry himself at different ages. And so this continues as well with Picard goes down to the planet, and he has the adventure there, and Riker and Geordi stay back on the Enterprise E and have the sort of the space fight there. So how does that work to split the two up again? Are the stories complementary, or does the Riker one feel a little tacked on?
You've already said it because you already know the answer.
Yeah, it does. It totally does.
Also, why
I'm
Riker
not sure what
and
the whole
Geordi?
Point of that was. Yeah. Yeah, why Riker and Geordi? And there's also that absurd moment when, you know, the crew finds out that Picard is, you know, going to go rogue.
With the costumes.
And they all, and they all show up in, like, that cargo hold on the Enterprise.
Yep.
And it's just like, you know, all right, somebody needs to go help Picard. Worf, you go with him. Data, you go with him. Why is, like, almost the entire command crew leaving the ship?
Yeah.
It's like, I mean,
Yeah, I think there's a disconnect because it's right after Picard takes off his pips, right? So he's like, I'm leaving Starfleet if this is what it's come to. And I think there's a disconnect because we don't see the rest of the crew being informed of what's going on.
No.
But I think they have been, because once they show up, they're like, you know, we couldn't stand by and let this happen, kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what happened behind this, at least what I got from watching it, is like behind the scenes, Picard tells everyone what's going on and he's all disappointed and they kind of suspect he's going to do something. So they're watching and they're like, oh, it was smart of you to try to reroute the transporter, but of course no one uses the transporter after 2 a.m, so we found you.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And all this stuff. So he left little breadcrumbs that they found.
Sure.
And then they show up and they're like, so, you know, they say something about we couldn't, you know, we couldn't stand by and let this happen, kind of a thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we're here to help you.
Captain, how could I see another sunrise knowing what it cost these people?
Yeah, right, Geordi.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. That's a line.
Yeah, I just thought it was goofy when I'm like watching it the other day.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like almost the entire command crew leaves the Enterprise.
And they've predicted how Picard is going to split up the crew because Geordi and Riker are in their uniforms and the other guys
are
wearing.
Oh my god, that's true.
Yeah.
That's so true. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's why he chose them. He's like, well, you're still in uniform.
Oh, yeah.
So.
If you're dressed for it, let's go to the planet.
Yeah. Otherwise, take the ship back.
Yeah. Okay, so now we talked a little bit about that. I don't know if we're talking about them more. What do we think about the Sona and Baku as, I guess, the Baku are kind of the victims and the Sona are the villains? Do we like them? Yes. No, I do want to say I love the actor F. Murray Abraham, right? I mean,
he's
an Academy Award-winning actor for Celluloid and Amadeus.
And Amadeus, which was so
it's
good.
It's amazing. Did you know Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker, played Mozart in Amadeus on Broadway, but they didn't cast him in the movie because they didn't want the association with Star Wars?
Oh, bummer.
Yeah, if that had happened.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Yeah, but if that had happened, Mark Hamill's career would have been very different.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Feel bad for the guy being typecast.
Yeah, well, yeah, that was the first time he was typecast. Anyway, it's relevant because it's, you know, has the word star in the title. But so we love F. Murray Abraham as an actor. What do we think of the Sona as bad guys? Because there's one line I really like when Riker and Troy are becoming experts on them and they're reading through like some bad things that the Sona do. Like they supplied Ketracel White, which is the to the Jem'Hadar during the Dominion War, and they've been involved like in slave labor and stuff. And I love this line where Troy says, what are we doing in business with these people? And so
we get the impression that they're kind of bad guys. And they're also just kind of volatile and mean people.
Yeah.
At least we're off
they have a lot of issues. They have a lot of issues.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But as villains, though, they're kind of lame.
They are,
to be honest.
They are lame. They're very lame.
Like everybody under Raffo seems like completely hapless. Like they don't.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
they can be easily. They're easily manipulated. They're kind of cowardly. Like I don't know, which maybe drives home the fact that they aren't really in the business of
being bad.
Being bad guys so much as they just want to go home.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, but yeah, they're kind of lame. I mean, F. Murray Abraham, Raffo is the only compelling character of that bunch, in my opinion.
Yeah, agreed.
I also love that bit where
he's the one we interact with the most.
Sure.
Yeah.
I love. There's a bit where he loses his temper and he kind of bleeds out of his forehead.
Yeah, it's so gross. Yeah. It makes like a slushy sound.
Yeah.
And Picard looks disgusted.
And so does Admiral Daugherty, who he's standing next to.
Yeah.
Admiral Daugherty has a lot of good looks. When things happen, he very often looks like he's disgusted with himself.
Mm.
Like he knows like he's doing this horrible thing and he's trying to, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm reading way too much into it, but I felt like that's what I got from him when he gives these looks when things happen.
No, I just think he's disgusted that he has to be in business with somebody like Raffo.
I agree.
What that is. I think Daugherty completely believes in what he's doing.
And here's the thing that I wanted Daugherty to say, that would have, justified his actions maybe a little bit, or at least shown the audience why he feels so strongly about this, is the Federation has just gotten through with a very bloody war with the Dominion in which literally millions of people have been killed, right? And how many more have been injured? And so if you're worried about your people being weakened, and you've got a lot of shipmates who, have suffered horrible injuries from the Dominion, and they need some sort of outstanding medical intervention, and all of a sudden you find the Fountain of Youth, maybe you'd be seriously motivated to do this. So I think it would have been nice to have said something like that, because they do reference the Dominion War. I mean, that's the
Yeah, a
whole
couple
reason.
times.
Yeah.
Right at the beginning,
Yeah, that's
right.
the whole reason that they have that diplomatic scene is Picard says, if we count our losses to the Borg and the Dominion, we need all the friends we can get. And so I think it would have been okay in that context for them to talk about something that was more idiosyncratic to Deep Space Nine. You know who else it would have been okay to have talk about that would have been Lieutenant Worf or Lieutenant Commander Worf, because he'd been heavily involved in the Dominion War. So I think that's a loss from a continuity standpoint, and it's a loss from like an understanding point. Like, I don't want to see. I mean, typically admirals turn out to be jerks or villains in Star Trek because they need to make the captain the hero, right? And so I think here would have been a good opportunity for us to show a little bit more of a rational side for why he's doing what he's doing. Now, the other thing that I've heard some people say about this that they should have done is when the crew gets there, the crew should have had differing opinions about this. Some like if you're Dr. Crusher and you say, this is the most amazing medical breakthrough of all time, how can 600 people hog it to themselves when we could share it with a galaxy of people? Dr. Crusher should have been on the other side. There's absolutely.
Yeah, but that's yeah, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
But that's part of the problem with TNG. Nobody ever argues with anybody.
Yeah, do you think Dr. Pulaski would have just rolled over and gone down to shoot a purple space bazooka?
No.
No! She would have joined Admiral Doherty.
Probably.
That's why Pulaski is not on the crew anymore, just saying.
Team Pulaski.
Team Crusher.
I'm totally Team Pulaski.
Look, we have to go into this again. She calls
No,
Data
we're not getting into
data,
it.
and she calls him it. That's just mean.
Yes, and she and as and over the course of the of that
She
season,
grows.
she started to come
She
around to
grows.
Data.
She grows.
Yes,
Too
she
late.
does.
Too
In
late,
peak
Pulaski.
performance, she's worried about Data's self-esteem, right? That's how she far along she
Okay.
comes.
We're going off
Anyway,
topic, guys.
okay, so
We could do a whole
my
hour
fault.
on Kate Pulaski and
Let's
Beverly
do that.
Crusher.
Let's do that. Okay, now how did this compare? I mentioned the Dominion War. I think one of the things that Insurrection suffers from is Deep Space Nine and Voyager were really doing great at the same time in 1998 when this came out. I was looking
Great
at some of
year.
the episode of Voyager that aired right before Insurrection. Is this episode called 30 Days? And what happens is Tom Paris has. He's disobeyed the captain, and so she's punishing him, and she sentences him to the brig for 30 days. And this is one of those episodes where Voyager is really following through on its commitment to be a little bit more gritty and realistic. Because typically, what happens in Star Trek is you disobey a direct order from the evil or incompetent admiral, you save the day, and then they pat you on the back at the end. And here's an example where Tom Paris tries to do that, and she says, "No, you're in the chain of command. You got to do what I tell you. Go to jail." For 30 days. And so, and that's just, the one that I picked out from, because it happened, came out right before, the same week that Insurrection came out. But they were doing great things on those episodes, on those seasons of the two subsequent series. And so I think you look at Insurrection at the time and you say, how is this a big deal? Why should we care about this? I don't know.
In terms of why it took a creative left turn and didn't become what we want it to
And
be.
was and just did it wasn't a time, I think, given that there were two series that were coming out with good episodes every week, it was not the time to do a movie that feels like an episode.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely.
Yeah.
I agree with that completely.
I mean, this is at a time where it was the second year of the Dominion War. They'd hit their stride with Seven of Nine, and every episode they were doing with her was awesome and being well received. I don't know, it just didn't make any sense. Anyway,
Yeah,
no,
I
I don't
agree.
know. Taylor, do you have any thoughts on that, or am I just a ranting old
No,
man?
I'm just thinking to myself, because I think a lot of my perspectives are different from your guys's in the fact that mine, I don't remember when I saw Insurrection, if I saw it during, right when it came out in theaters or not until later, and I wasn't following Deep Space Nine and Voyager religiously at that time.
Oh, okay. So it's a
So
little
it's a, the movie's
different.
in a complete the movie's in a completely different context for me, and I think that's true of a lot of the movies we've talked about. A lot of times, I'm really interested to hear your guys' perspective in terms of what was the feeling of Star Trek like at the time that it came out? And then, so you have these opinions probably based on your first viewing of it, and you probably thought a lot about it at that time. And for me, it was more of a, you know, it's just a movie in part of the universe. So I, at the time, I didn't have that bias to, you know, putting it in the context of the greater universe.
See, to me, this was an example of how Deep Space Nine had, in my own preferences, had accelerated vastly beyond what TNG had ever done. Because if you look at First Contact, I mean, they go out of their way. They made an episode that explained why the command crew, except for Worf, wasn't able to be at the Battle of Sector 001. The next episode after First Contact, all the Deep Space Nine crew were wearing the new uniforms, and it was just, nope. And then there's that shot, I think that's such a ton shot, of the Defiant coming in at the Borg cube, and it gets stuck in the tractor beam, and then the Enterprise E comes in and totally saves the day. And the message is, yeah, you think the Defiant is cool, but don't forget who your daddy is. Whereas with this, I feel like TNG is trying to play catch-up to Deep Space Nine, where they say, you know, we just had this awesome Dominion War thing.
Dominion, yeah.
Yeah, and instead of showing what the Enterprise E was doing during the Dominion War, which might have been cool, they say, we have to, you know, Captain Sisko was just doing all this awesome stuff. Well, we have to do this little stuff afterward that's kind of clean up.
Yeah.
Anyway, I didn't mean to go off on as much of a rant on that, but since you asked.
No, it's a good point.
Yeah, and I think it's unfortunate that it couldn't maintain its status as quote unquote the daddy of the series, of the franchise, at the time. There's even, and I think it's on YouTube, there's even like a deleted scene where after they save the day, like Quark shows up on the planet.
What?
Because he's gonna start a spa or something like that.
Yep.
And it's like even more like we kind of, Deep Space Nine is so cool that we wish their most interesting character were in this as a cameo, in a way that,
yeah. It actually worked. Well, they didn't use it obviously, but apparently, like, you know, he comes and he's like has all these grand plans, like Jared said, like build a spa or something.
Yeah.
And Picard puts the kibosh on it and says, turns to Worf and says, "Worf, bring him back to Deep Space Nine." And Worf goes, "Do I have to?" But it's a little too inside baseball, I think, for the general audience. I think that's why he's not in there, because, like, I think people are like, who's this weird looking dude?
Yeah, that just seems random and unnecessary to me.
Yeah, well, like I said, it was very inside baseball.
Yeah. Okay, now here's another thing that I want, that I think mostly the TNG movies suffer from, is I feel like they're operating off the first season Bible. I feel like they're not taking all the growth and development that the characters made from the end of season 7 to moving on, but they basically just kind of say, well, if you've only seen Encounter or Farpoint, then you'd get this. And a couple things that key into that are Riker and Troy getting back together, which is, I think, nobody really cared about, and Data acting... maybe that's just me. Maybe Jonathan Frakes cared about it because he wanted to shoot a scene with him and bring a certain
back time. I think so.
To be fair, I can't argue that. But also, like, Data acting like a little kid. Like, there's, you know, because there's the little kid Baku that he's playing with. And he says to Data, have a little fun every day. Like, you know, and the thing that reminded me of, the line that came to my mind when I saw this, was when Q says to Picard, you've spent the last 7 years indulging Data in his, quote, witless exploration of humanity.
Yeah.
And the whole idea of, you know, Geordi having issues with being blind. It's like they talked about it in the first season, but never again. And so I feel like there was a lot of growth that happened on the show that they abandoned for these movies. Anyway.
Well, I have to tell you, one of my favorite moments in the movie is Geordi being able to see that sunrise.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and he's so emotional about it. And like it, to me, that might be one of my, if not my favorite moment in the movie, definitely one of my favorites. Like, I think that's great. And I had no problem with Riker and Troy getting together, because to be perfectly honest, I think we've talked about this before. Once it became obvious that Riker was not going to leave the Enterprise anytime soon, I don't know why they didn't resume their relationship, to be perfectly honest.
No.
Like, it made, like, the whole point of him of them breaking up in the first place is because he was so career driven, sure, had no room in his life for anything but his career. Once it became
kind of, obvious, kind of like James Kirk, basically James Kirk 2.0.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Riker is in many ways, Kirk Light. But I just don't understand. I never understood why they just didn't resume their relationship much sooner than they do in this movie. So I had no problem with them finally getting back together. Okay. I was like, well, finally, what the hell took so long?
Okay, yes. I guess the thing I feel is not that it bugs me so much that they got back together, but that Picard and Beverly never didn't get together, right? Because there's that awesome thread through the seventh season with the episode Attached, and then again in All Good Things where it says they got married and then divorced, where I feel like their romance was more interesting to me. And maybe Patrick Stewart just wanted to have a different on-screen love interest with the Anja lady, who I feel is just so unnecessary.
I mean, wouldn't this have been more... I don't know if that's... I don't know if that was a Patrick Stewart thing, though, because, like, we talked about this...
It was Patrick.
Oh, well, all right. Patrick. But we talked about this in our... when we talked about First Contact, you know, film Picard is not the same thing as television show Picard.
Right.
Yeah. And, like, you know, in First Contact, just like Lily was the leading lady and Patrick was the leading man, in this movie, you know, he's leading man and Anja is the leading lady, and you have to, you know, I feel like it's a classic movie formula to to connect the new people to the ones we know, and there's got to be a love interest and blah blah blah, and Picard's got to be the, you know, got to be the hero and get the girl and all this stuff.
Sure, but go ahead, Brian.
And touching on what Killer just said about how movie Picard and TV Picard are two different people, I mean, pardon me, Jean-Luc Picard in the final three Star Trek movies shoots a gun more than he did in 7 years of Star Trek.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah.
They turn him into an action hero.
Yeah.
That is not the thoughtful philosopher anymore. He is completely, you know, Patrick worked out, got these guns on, you know, Patrick was like jacked and like, he became a completely different character because I think Patrick
did not want
to sit on board the Enterprise while Jonathan was running around on a planet shooting people.
Yeah, and that's
I'm telling you.
No, like we talked about at the beginning.
What are the issues? Yeah.
Oh, no, just that they always had the two characters on two different missions, where Picard had the more cerebral mission on the ship and Riker had the more action-oriented away mission. They flipped those.
Right.
So Picard can be the action hero, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know that Patrick used to chafe at that even during the series. I mean, when he first met Ron Moore, one of the first things he told Ron after he met him and, you know, congratulated him on his script was, just remember, the captain doesn't do enough fighting and screwing on this show.
and that's why they did the episode Captain's Holiday where he goes to Risa.
That's totally why they did it.
Yeah.
Excellent. Which Patrick, is a great
Patrick
episode.
Patrick was tired of just sitting on the ship.
Yeah. I mean, look, the conceit...
The whole conceit behind, you know, the captain remaining on the ship while the first officer went on away missions, that was something David Gerald came up with in the 70s as like kind of a criticism of the original series. And blah, blah. It is perfectly, it's perfectly sensible if you're a real starship going out in space.
Yeah.
Right. Which we're not.
From a dramatic television standpoint, it's kind of lame.
Yeah, it is. I agree.
It is. No question.
And it gets kind of exposed by the fact that, you know, when they made the movies, they completely threw the formula out and basically turned Picard into another version of Kirk.
Well, and there's plenty of examples even in the Next Generation television series where they sort of be like, yeah, well, Captain's not supposed to go down, but I'm going, bye.
Yeah.
And certainly as the show went on, that became more. Oh, and in fact, you know, to refer to what I said about the movies, like cribbing too much from the first season, there's even a line at their wedding in Nemesis, where he like makes a little joke about Riker not letting him go on away missions, and I'm like, that's 14 years.
Data.
Oh, it's Data. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a tyrannical martinet.
Wow. Good for wow. I doff my hat to you that you could outquote me on this. I do not know Nemesis as well as I guess I should.
I always love that line though. He's a tyrannical martinet.
Yeah, that is good.
It's a very Picard thing to say. Picard thing.
You know what's not? Okay, now what's not a Picard thing to say? To continue the idea of him being a phony action hero is he's there with Ruathel on the collection, the ship at the end, and he's ordered it to be self-destructed, and he's beaming himself off, and he says to Ruathel, "Time's up," and then beams out like he's he's Bruce Willis
so
in Die Hard. Right.
It's so
like, yeah, I was about to say he sounds like Bruce Willis in Die Hard. Yeah. Happy trails. Huh?
Or like Sean Connery and James Bond or Roger Moore making some kind of wisecrack, and it's like, wait a minute, it would be just as easy for him to say, "Enterprise, two to beam over." Right. There's no reason that.
That is dramatic, though.
Wow, I know, but it's so
unfitting.
Was
it? I'm trying to remember. Was he in a situation where he could have saved Ruathel?
Very easily.
I think so.
Very easily. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's kind
of... That was probably another conceit. That was probably another concession to Patrick to make Picard more of an action hero.
Yeah, the other thing is like...
No, I meant the Time's Up Ruathel thing is kind
of...
Well,
no, but they could have done it where, like, so he didn't have communication with the ship, and they didn't know Ruathel was there. They could have done something, so it wasn't like he was purposely killing him.
Yeah, they could have done a Commander Krug. Yeah, they could have done a Commander Krug where he says, "Ruathel, come with me," and he says, "I'd rather die than come with you." That would have been better.
Yeah, that's not even, it's more than not Picard, that's not Star Trek.
No. And it's like,
not
TNG,
for sure.
And at that point...
Are we sure that Picard could actually reach out and grab him?
Well, he could when he gives the order to be beamed over, he just could have said Enterprise 2 to beam over, right?
That's true.
I mean, they knew he was on there. They have life form identification technology to the point that's how they identify that the Sonon and the Barku are one species. Anyway.
Right.
Okay, now talking about the end. Now, Brian, you rewatched some of the extras and you said that the ending was different from how it may have originally been written. And I'm not not just the plot stuff.
Yeah, well, they're on that ship, Picard and Ruathel. You know, they're on that...
The collector.
The collector. They're on the collector. And I think... they don't show you the entire sequence, but Picard... They're tangling on that platform, and I think Picard accidentally... Or shoots... They're in the middle of a gunfight, and a laser blast activates, like, this platform, and it starts to shoot upwards, and ultimately it ends up launching Ruathel. I don't know, they don't make it very clear, but like it seems like it launches him into the theater, that radiation ring where the collector is actually happening, and Ruathel starts to de-age.
And like he turns into a baby or something.
He doesn't get that far, but that's the intimation that he's going to end up like an embryo.
Okay.
Like he becomes, you see him, you see him at one point, he looks like he's about 30 years old, human, completely humanoid, 30-year-old, and then they cut away. But that was one of the pieces, I guess people thought that was anticlimactic, that he was just going to, go floating off into space and de-age or something like that.
But from an ironic...
That's the only, I can't speak to...
Yeah.
I can't speak to what else happens, because that's all the footage they show you, really.
Interesting. But from an ironic punishment standpoint, that makes sense. That's good. Yeah.
But I guess it was not the preview audiences that saw the film were not happy with the way it ended, so they reshot the ending, which is what you see now, which is where the collector ship blows up and all that other stuff happens. Mm. You know, it's a much bigger, louder ending than had originally been conceived.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I didn't know at all.
I wish I could give you a little more detail about it, but I can only tell you what they showed us, which is not a whole hell of a lot.
Yeah. Is that online somewhere?
It probably is.
You can see.
If not, for those of you that own the Blu-ray or the DVDs, it's in there.
We'll see if we can find that and put it up.
Yeah, good idea. Kate, now is there anything else from?
It's got to be on YouTube somewhere, because it's not really part of the feature itself. It's just a deleted scene, you know. So, anyway, I'm sorry, Jared.
Ending, huh? Ending theme. Is there anything else from the extras that stood out that you thought would be cool to share? Because I don't think I've ever watched them.
Not really. No, that was kind of, it's just a lot of cool background stuff. I mean, I don't know if you guys realize that when Michael Piller originally conceived of this idea, he wanted to do Heart of Darkness.
Yeah, in fact, that's next on my list of things I wanted to talk about, because is the book Fade In, which is his book about Insurrection, which is more interesting than Insurrection.
Right, right. Which was recently released by Piller's wife.
Yep. And so you,
for an absurd amount of money.
Well, good, good. You know, she deserves it. Now, have you
just to give a little background on that book real quick.
Yeah, yeah.
That book, Michael wrote that book, I guess, concurrent with when he was writing the film, and with the intention of having it published. It's more of a, it's while it's also a making of Insurrection, it's also designed to be like a how-to guide for aspiring screenwriters.
It's like a textbook,
Yeah, that was his intention. So he didn't think it was going to be any big deal releasing it. But
more from the standpoint of this is what you have to put up with to get a movie made, rather than this is how you write a screenplay.
Right, right. So yeah, the process that you have to go through, right, to some degree. And so he didn't think it was going to be a big deal. He wrote the thing up, blah, blah, blah. Paramount did not want to release it because it makes several people, including, I think, Patrick, and I think Rick Berman, and a few other people, not look too great.
Yeah.
In certain spots. So they kind of pulled it back. I mean, I read it a while ago. So what ended up happening to the book is it kind of just like, I don't know whether Michael himself released it over the internet or if one of his family members did, but there's been a PDF of it floating around for years.
Yeah, I read it, I think in 2013 or 2014. But
I read it a few years back. It's good. It's definitely worth reading.
It's terrific. It's terrific. And I think, you know, we talk about Patrick Stewart's ego and whatever, but it illustrates more about like the things that were wrong with the way the TNG movies got made than I think anything else that there is, because we have to deal with Rick Berman, who's in charge of this, when he's still managing this Empire, which is now two TV shows, and he didn't seem creatively invested in it at all. And we've got Patrick Stewart, who's worried about, he's constantly talking about worrying about Stewart's ego, where he says, the subject is about like the fountain of youth and getting younger. And he says, and Rick Berman says to him, is this what you want to say to our star? As we say, you're too old. That's how you want to start the conversation for the follow-up to First Contact. We have to deal with like budget issues, where he has these more grandiose ideas and it keeps getting cut in half. I can't remember many details about interacting with Jonathan Frakes, but just that Frakes was excited to do the next movie. But, he said, great, you want to do the next movie? Great. How'd you like to do it for half as much as you did the last one?
One did so well.
It did so well.
And I did feel bad for Jonathan. I felt like Jonathan should have been born into the process sooner. Jonathan was basically handed a script and said, this is the picture you're shooting.
Yeah, he should have been in charge.
Like the creative thrust of Insurrection is Michael Piller, Rick Berman, Patrick Stewart, and Brent Spiner.
Yeah. And now the thing is, though, if I recall, Piller's original vision was that Data would have been the bad guy. He would have been the Kurtz from Heart of Darkness.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, Heart of Darkness, right. The initial conceit was to do a Heart of Darkness story where, right, Data still would have malfunctioned and he still would have, you know, maybe taken some of the Baku hostage or whatever he was going to do. And yeah, and then he was going to basically be this Kurtz character who was going to be like living off in the jungle. And Picard was going to be the, I forget the name of the character in Heart of Darkness.
The Martin Sheen.
But he, yeah, well, yeah, or in Apocalypse Now, Willard, the Willard character, yeah. Right? And he was going to go down the river. And as he and Picard and like, you know, some of the rest of the crew are, you know, basically quote unquote going down the river, mm-hmm. they were going to start the aging and like a lot of different things were going to start to happen to them.
Yeah. And
but they could not, but Piller admitted that he couldn't make a lot of these different elements work together. Yeah. So they ultimately abandoned the Heart of Darkness concept. It's a shame too, because I would have liked to have seen a movie like that.
It would have been much more interesting. The leftover from that you see is Data going nuts at the beginning, where it's like because it's pointless. It doesn't really add anything to the movie. That much, except to say, here's a mystery that's going to be resolved in 10 minutes. And while you're also asking the question, why on earth is Data assigned detail to this mission?
That's the biggest thing, I think. Why the hell is Data there? What's he doing there is the weirdest part. But I actually kind of like the rest of it. if you can ignore that it makes no sense for Data to be off the ship and doing this random thing.
Yeah.
Because it's a hook at the beginning. So just from like a sort of film standpoint, ignoring the television universe of Star Trek, if this was just a film. Yeah. I feel like it works because it's a hook at the beginning. It's exciting. It makes you go, well, why is Data doing this? And then when the reason is that he was damaged and his moral compass took over. So so Picard said, so he still knew the difference between right and wrong? And Geordi says, that's the only thing he knew.
Mm.
So that's sort of a foreshadowing to say that he figured something out that's going on. That where it makes like Starfleet are the bad guys here. So
which
we need
again,
to figure out what's going on.
Which again, that was going to be the original conflict, is Data was going to be like that the whole movie. And that's why he and Picard come at odds with each other.
Right.
Yeah. It works for me as a sort of foreshadowing thing.
Sure. Also, we talked about the lightheartedness. There's a line where he's basically been put in timeout, and he says to Picard, I am missing several memory engrams, and Geordi pulls
the
phone out, and he says, there they are. It's just
there
a nice little joke.
There they are.
I like that. So
yeah, me too.
So yeah, I can't strongly recommend enough that you read Fade In. And it's not that long. I think it's like 80 pages, 100 pages. It's not that long.
Yeah.
So
it's not for the length. It's what, like a dollar a page?
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe a little more than that. Yeah. If you buy the book, I mean that $95 for that is absurd.
Oh
yeah,
wow.
It's a little much.
Oh, I didn't realize it was
that
much.
Yeah, a little. I wouldn't pay half that for that book.
No, I mean, it's cool that they're doing it, but I don't understand why they set that price point.
It should be $9.99. That's what it should cost.
Or if you want to make a deluxe, if you want to make a deluxe thing out of it, maybe charge $20 or $30 or something.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, $95.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah. Especially
I didn't realize it was so short. When I was reading that it was supposed to be like a textbook, I thought, well, okay, that's actually a cheap textbook if it's really, because textbooks are so overpriced.
Unless there's more to it than what was released online. I don't know.
Yeah.
Even so, $95 is an absurd.
That's
way too much. That's like a season on Blu-ray price right there.
Yeah, it's much more expensive actually than a season.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. $60 for a season of Blu-ray.
Oh, that's it. Oh,
maybe even
down.
Less. So, yeah. So, anywho.
Okay, so unless either of you has anything else you want to say about the Fade In, I want to sort of circle back on what I said at the beginning about what the theme stated of the movie is.
Go.
Okay. Taylor, do you have anything else before I launch into this tirade?
I'm just going to say I think there are multiple themes.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Including the ones that I mentioned before, Fountain of Youth, forced relocation, family, boobs firming up, those kinds of things.
Not that we care about that.
None of the themes really seem to tie together, though.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like these disparate themes that are thrown around the movie, and none of it, like, it doesn't coalesce into anything meaningful at the end. And that's part of the movie's problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I just want to say one more thing about, I remember my initial reaction when I heard what the plot of Insurrection was, and the Enterprise finds the Fountain of Youth was basically the first headline that came out of this movie when it first was announced.
Yeah, boring.
And all I could remember, and not only that, but I also thought, wow, that is like a stereotypical Star Trek plot.
Kind of, yeah. What does God want with a starship?
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly like that. But it's exactly like, Star Trek goes, the Enterprise goes in search of God. The Enterprise goes in search of the Fountain of Youth. It's like, what?
Yeah.
It's like, why?
Yeah, so already, by the time that movie came out, I was already like a little leery of it.
Okay.
Because it already felt kind of uninspired. But anywho, I had to interject.
Okay, I'm glad you did, because you just actually reminded me of something. The other thing that Insurrection came out in the shadow of, which I had completely forgotten after 17 years of cynicism, was the impending release of Star Wars Episode 1. Because we knew that was going to come out
the following year,
just a few months later.
Yeah.
And people really cared about that. There's never been a movie more highly anticipated than The Phantom Menace. And so having similar... Yeah, and I remember...
It's
like,
so sad, though.
I know, but at the time, and the internet was still kind of new, and it was like, hey, there's pictures of this cool space race they're going to do on Phantom Menace on the internet. Let's look at them.
Yeah.
Like, that was huge. And so for this to come out and be so underwhelming was terrible timing. I mean, not as terrible timing, Star Trek Nemesis coming out a week before Lord of the Rings: The Two Towers was released, but still very unfortunately bad timing for Insurrection.
Yeah.
Because then it makes it seem
well,
even
I don't think
smaller.
It affected its box office or anything. It was just a creatively uninspired movie. Had they made a better movie, I think they would have been fine. I don't think Star Wars' box office affects Star Trek's in any way.
No, either. But I think it just made people less excited for it.
The anticipation.
There was something else that was more interesting going on. Okay, so this is why I... So anyway, thanks for that interjection, because I appreciated that Patsy took us down. Okay, so this is what I think... is the theme of Insurrection, and it's actually, this is a quote from Ruafo that I'm going to play for you. We have this wonderful MP3 here.
We should send down an assault team and take them by force.
That is not an acceptable option.
If people get hurt, all the support we have in the Federation...
Federation support.
Federation procedures. Federation rules. Look in the mirror, Admiral. The Federation is old. In the past 24 months, they've been challenged by every major power in the Quadrant. The Borg, the Cardassians, the Dominion. They all smell the scent of death on the Federation. That's why you've embraced our offer. Because it will give your dear Federation new life. Well, how badly do you want it, Admiral? Because there are hard choices to be made now. If the Enterprise gets through with news about their brave captain's valiant struggle on behalf of the defenseless Baku, your Federation politicians will waver. Your Federation opinion polls will open a public debate. Your Federation allies will want their say. Need I go on?
Now, doesn't that sound like a pretty damning indictment of the Star Trek franchise in 1998?
Yeah, it does.
I mean, because you know what that is? That's Michael Piller talking to Rick Berman right there. He's saying, I'm sick of the rules that you've enforced on us for the last 11 years. We need to be able to do something different. And he lists off, you thought the Borg were cool, the Cardassians were cool, the Dominion are cool, and now we're stuck with this? And then even talking about they smell the scent of death on the Federation. That's saying people think this franchise is old and past its prime.
Mm-hmm. Did they? I mean, like you were
saying. I don't know. Not 98, Jerry.
Creatively, though.
I don't feel like Star Trek had fallen off a cliff yet at that point. That was the beginning of it, though, right around
then. It was on the way. Like, it was on the way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think this is so much about the franchise itself. I remember watching it and just thinking, gosh, how did they print this? They're looking in the mirror right there. Anyway.
I don't know if it, I personally don't know if that's exactly what he was doing. Yeah. But
maybe subconsciously?
Maybe. I just don't. And as far as the restrictions go, Michael Piller liked being in the box.
Oh, did he?
He has said that many times over the years. Yeah, he liked the Roddenberry box.
Oh, okay.
He did. He considered it an intellectual exercise, like to try to like work within Gene's boundaries, which is why the show kind of stabilized a bit when he took over in the third season, because he kind of figured out a way to make it all work within Gene's rules.
He knew how to do it. Mm.
So, yeah, he did. No, but I think it's good that somebody actually, to get to your back to your point, like I think it's good that somebody actually does criticize the Federation once in a while.
Yeah,
we tend to see a very like one-sided view of what the United Federation of Planets does, and it's interesting to see someone else's viewpoint on it.
See, which also goes in line with what they were doing at the time with like Quark and Garak, you know, comparing the Federation to root beer, or the whole stuff with the Maquis, which. I mean, Michael Piller, he basically created the Maquis, right? Because he created Voyager.
Right.
So I think it's all going in the same venue. The other thing where I kind of feel like the scent of death and the idea of the franchise being a little too long in the tooth is if they're talking about this issue of worrying about being too old, that's rehashing the same theme as Wrath of Khan, where it's Kirk dealing with his midlife crisis. And so I feel like that's and that was also the theme of Star Trek Generations. So in a way, kind of also the theme of in Undiscovered Country, although Undiscovered Country with a more meaningful coda to the first installment of the franchise.
Right, and Undiscovered Country was more about the wall coming down.
Sure. It was about
that was the overarching.
It was about the end of the Cold War and the end of the original series, and the two were tied together beautifully.
Yes, they were.
Yeah, but here I just feel like people like Wrath of Khan. We always talk about being old in Star Trek, I guess we should talk about it again. Anyway, so that's my.
I don't think they hit you over the head with the age thing in this movie, though. Like Picard's not sitting down having like some sort of like midlife crisis about the fact that he's getting older.
Yeah, like Kirk was.
Yeah, Kirk was very clearly having one.
Sure, to the point where Kirk doesn't smile until the very last scene of the movie. But, I mean, the idea of talking about aging and you know, is throughout the whole thing with Worf's pimple or Deanna's boobs or Geordi's, not Geordi's eyes as much, or Riker shaving his beard off to show I'm going back to a younger version of my character.
Yeah.
So that's definitely, and like Picard dancing a salsa, right? Which I actually do like that scene.
Mambo, but yeah.
Mambo, thank you. Wow. I'm just gonna mess with him. Thank you.
I just watched it last night. It's unfair.
Okay. even still. So anyway, there you go. That's my rant. I think this is the theme, unintentional or intentional, of Star Trek Insurrection.
All right.
It's franchise fatigue.
It is definitely the first sign that we saw, I think, that Star Trek was probably starting to run out of gas.
It was also the sign that the TNG franchise was not going to be the same as the TOS franchise, because, you know, they kind of stumbled a little bit with Generations. That's okay. First Contact is terrific, and I think the sense was, okay, every 2 years we're going to do this until we've made at least 6 movies, and they're all going to be moderately successful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. It's a shame. Insurrection really put the kibosh on the TNG movies. It's a shame. They were coming off such great momentum with First Contact.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think if Nemesis hadn't been so crap, I think it's harsh to blame Insurrection. Maybe I just don't know, but it seems harsh to blame Insurrection when
but they were planning on shutting down the franchise after Nemesis anyway. Even if Nemesis had made $100 million more than it made, they were still planning on shutting it down.
Yeah. You think they wouldn't change their minds?
Well, there were other issues too. I don't think Patrick wanted to do any more. I don't think Brent wanted to do any more. Mm. They were kind of done. But it would have been better to go out in better style than they did.
Yeah, it's too bad.
That's a podcast for another day.
Yeah, which when we get to Nemesis, I'm sure we can explore that. I do want to say in terms of blaming Insurrection for the movie franchise not going much better. If you look at it, the first one comes out in 94, then 96, then 98, and then they waited 4 years to do the next one. And I don't think, I think that was bad.
Yeah, like
they lost a tremendous amount of momentum. The other thing, Insurrection had a production budget of $58 million, domestic gross, $70
million. Yeah.
And worldwide, it made $112 million. So they say in order to be profitable, you have to make double your production budget. They didn't do that.
Yeah. Long-running franchises are all about momentum.
Yeah.
And, like, that movie caused the momentum to slam, like, shut. Like, there was just, like, it slowed everything down. Because they were flying high after First Contact,
sure.
Guys. I mean, it was, you know,
tremendously high. And the other two shows were doing well. People were going to conventions.
It kind of just... And rightly or wrongly, the movies at that time were like the standard bearer of the franchise. Like if you know, a big movie could lift, what they say, the rising tide lifts all boats.
Yep.
Like if a Star Trek movie does really well, it kind of lifts the entire franchise up.
Yeah.
And that movie falling flat, I think, as Jared said, you know, added the perception that Star Trek was starting to peter out.
Yeah. Yep, there was blood in the water, blood that erupted from Ruafo's weird squishy forehead.
It's a metaphor for the Star Trek franchise.
Ruafo's squishy forehead.
Okay, the other thing I want to say
on that note.
The last thing I want to say, Insurrection is also the shortest of all of the Star Trek movies.
It is. How long is it, Jared?
Let me see if I have that here. Runtime, 1 hour, 43 minutes.
Yeah, that's short.
And then when you consider a lot of the beginning, like with the Gilbert and Sullivan song and the Mambo and whatnot, that's kind of padding or filler, I guess is what it's called. So you cut that out, and there's really not a lot of the actual story.
Agreed. I love the stuff with Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yes,
I love
that's
that
perfect.
Whole
sequence. That's perfect. And then
it really is.
And then it's even got the line of Worf, do you know Gilbert and Sullivan? I've not had a chance to familiarize myself with all the new crewmen since my return. That's terrific. I mean, the whole idea of the alien who doesn't get the human idiom or cultural reference, that is not a new joke by any measure. And so when you can do it and it still makes you laugh, that's good.
Yeah.
Yep. Totally. That's funny.
Okay, well, there we go. There we go.
Star Trek Insurrection, everybody.
We got that one in the can.
And we'll move on to Nemesis next. So get your knives out, everybody.
Yeah, get your pitchforks sharpened.
I don't know. I think I always go back in my mind which for Insurrection or Nemesis, which I might prefer more. And the thing about Nemesis is I actually think the story, the concept of the story is pretty good. Like the scheme that the...
Well, it knows the story it wants to tell. That's
for sure. Yeah, depressing.
It is depressing. No.
It is, but at least it knows what it is. Yeah, I will say that.
I'd rather watch Insurrection 100 times over.
I agree. I agree with you. But from like a story standpoint, there's a clear plot, there's a clear villain, there's a clear theme that's stated, and it's resolved. I think it's the inverse of Insurrection. Where Insurrection is well directed but badly written. Nemesis is decently written and horribly directed. Hmm. Anyway, that's it. Yeah. We'll save that for another time. I do want to end with a quick Trek anecdote, if that's okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so I am in a grad program right now, and we just finished our first class project, and it's an international program. I'm the only one on my team who's a native English speaker, so they put me in charge of writing the final project after I did all the research. I did not know how to end it, so for the conclusion, I literally just wrote the line, "The human adventure is just beginning."
Fantastic. Yeah. Did anyone notice?
Nope, they didn't, but they loved it.
Awesome.
Said, oh, well, that's so great.
You're such a good writer.
Yeah, exactly. Like, thank you. I came up with it. Anyway, so.
Thanks, Gene.
Yes, absolutely. I think TMP is having a little bit of a renaissance, like with some of the marketing for Star Trek Beyond being used.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's huge.
From the poster. So hopefully this contributes to that.
Yeah.
This essay that you've written.
This essay that I've written that will only be. Yep, that will only be read by my classmates and my teacher. Okay, there you go. Okay, well, thanks everyone for joining
us. That's great.
Thank you. Thank you for you. You're the one who inspired me to give TMP a second chance. I'm glad you did.
And I'm glad you did, John.
I have never been so delighted to lose an argument.
And I encourage all of you at home to give it another try.
And if you don't believe him, go listen to the first ever episode of the Shuttle Pod.
Yes.
That's right.
Thanks, Kayla. Bring it home. Okay, well, I guess that's it. Take care, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.